John Miller, welcome to the Bookshelf Conversations.
Hi, Ron. Thank you for having me.
Congratulations. Your new book, The Last Manager: How Earl Weaver Tricked, Tormented, and Reinvented Baseball, has won the coveted Spitball Magazine Casey Award.
Yeah, thanks. That was a very exciting, especially to get a call for an award from a magazine called Spitball. It's just part of the folklore of baseball.
So the first question I have is, well, the first question I'm going to ask is, why Earl Weaver? After all this time, he's not been with us for a while, and he's been out of the game for a good almost 40 years. So what was your fascination with him to make you write a book?
I grew up overseas as an Orioles fan. My parents are musicians who moved to Belgium in the 70s. So I grew up going to school in French, but having this love of baseball that was kind of, in my own mind and reading books in the 80s. And the Orioles had been an incredible team for the 20 years before I became a fan. I became a fan around 1986, 87, when they started being really bad. In 1988, they lost their first 21 games. And the Earl Weaver was kind of representative of this era where they were the best team in baseball. And so I would read these books about Earl Weaver. I read his memoir when I was 10 or 11 and was just fascinated by the voice and by the uniqueness of the character. This is a very funny, very smart person, obviously. And as I became more of a baseball player and coach myself, I started reading him more also as a baseball coach, like somebody who had a bunch of ideas and strategies that he put into place. And I became fascinated by if they worked or not. And what was the real reason for the Orioles being that good in the 70s? Was it Earl Weaver? Was it something else? Was it luck? And then when he died, I was on staff at the Wall Street Journal and I was covering the steel industry in Pittsburgh, but people knew I was an Orioles fan, an Orioles or a Weaver expert basically. And they asked me to write his obituary. And I was writing the obituary, I thought, Moneyball talks about Earl Weaver. All these books and magazine articles talk about how Earl Weaver was an early prophet of analytics, but nobody's done a book since analytics became a big thing, since Moneyball, about Earl Weaver, about where he came from, what his origin story was. And there are already four books by or about Earl Weaver. And so I knew I had to find new stuff. And so that's what set me on the path. But the question that you asked, I mean, that's what a lot of agents rejected the idea when I first approached them. And it took me 6 months of failing to sell the book because people said, well, we already know Earl Weaver. Like, what is there new to say about Earl Weaver?
I'm curious, growing up where you did, was it easy to find books on baseball in English?
No, people sent me. So my parents had siblings in the U.S., so they would send me books in the mail as presents, and then we would come back here every year or two. And I would find books or newspaper clippings to read. Also, the paper we got as English-speaking Americans in Europe was the International Herald Tribune, and it was a compilation of the best of the Washington Post and the New York Times. And so they reprinted a lot of Tom Boswell's columns. And Tom Boswell was this great Washington Post writer who loved Earl Weaver. And so part of my entry to Earl Weaver was all these intellectuals and these writers like Roger Angell and the New Yorker and Tom Boswell, who all were like besotted with this guy. They thought he was this kind of, working class philosopher prophet kind of, who was very funny. And so because they loved him, I read about him in their writing. And so I fell in love with him too.
Of all the teams you could have picked, how did you pick the Orioles as your favorite team?
Both my parents are from Maryland. My mom's from Catonsville near Baltimore, and my dad's from Bowie, which is DC suburb. And so in the summers, that's where we would go. We would go to Maryland, and I had uncles who would take me to Memorial Stadium. And so I would spend, 10 months of the year in rainy Belgium going to school in French. And then America was like this, beautiful, there were no stresses in America. It was the summer and no school and people were happy. And it was like a really cool thing. And I just fell in love with baseball as a fan, but also as a player. I had uncles who pitched to me and then went back to Belgium. We had a really good little league in the 80s because of the Cold War and all the Americans stationed in Europe. There's very good youth baseball in Europe for me to play in. So that's how I became, really a baseball person.
I want to talk about the title of the book, and I want you to explain each adjective of the title. So you say how Earl Weaver tricked. Let's start with tricked.
Well, he was inventive, and it's in the sense of having tricks to win baseball games. And also his background, he grew up on the streets of St. Louis. His uncle was a bookie. He was kind of a wise guy, like in Damon Runyon stories. Like he had, you wouldn't really trust him. He was kind of a hustler, and so he corked a bat in the minor leagues, and he had his groundskeeper work on corking bats. The Orioles were never caught corking bats, but they experimented with it in batting practice. He was the first to use a radar gun, the first to have data in the dugout. So it's kind of a wide interpretation of the word trick, but it's essentially in a game you have secrets or strategies that you're not revealing immediately, and that you bring those to the table and try to win with those tricks, if you will. Tormented obviously is the umpires, and he was somebody who nobody really got along with in a kind of primary sense. He fought with everybody, but it was fruitful in a way. Like the players said after the fact, he pushed them and tormented them towards something that was bigger than themselves, that they were pushed to be better players, a better team. And obviously, a lot of umpires hated him. They thought he went over, was over the top. They didn't think he was funny. But that was just part of his who he was. And he was a complicated guy who had a lot of darkness to him too. I mean, his violence, and his uncle was a mobster, and I think probably beat him up. And he didn't come from a very happy place. So he had an alcohol problem, and he was tormented himself, and then it reinvented. I mean, he really was somebody who changed the way baseball is seen and watched and analyzed and played. And as I write in the book, nowadays they basically hire managers who think like Earl Weaver. You program computers to think like Earl Weaver. He, in addition to the radar gun, which I mentioned, he was always open to new ideas, and he would try things like he would bat his best pinch hitter leadoff in the game because he would think that at bat in the first inning is worth as much as in the ninth inning when you're gonna, if you're down by a run, why not just have him lead off the game? Then you put in your best defender who's not a good hitter after that to replace him. And not all these ideas stuck. I mean, that idea doesn't work anymore because everybody carries 12 or 13 pitchers, but he just tried everything. And so he tried everything, and a lot of things did kind of stick. Like his hatred of the bunt eventually, that's become basically part of the common belief system of baseball people. The radar gun obviously is there to stay, other kinds of technology. And just this idea that baseball is a very probabilistic sport where you respect the number of outcomes, and you don't overreact to the immediate game. Like you have an idea of the odds involved, much like a gambler, which he was. And so that's a mindset. Like front office people, like they won't talk about it on the record, but they'll say, we're obsessed with gambling. Like we read books about playing blackjack. Like it's a sport that has been enmeshed in the shadows of gambling, but now more overtly so because the math is so important and present. And Earl Weaver kind of made that happen. One of the people who made that happen.
So you mentioned his embrace of analytics. How do you think he would get along in today's baseball?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think he would struggle. I mean, he'd have to get sober. I mean, the kind of drinking he did is not something that would stand. I mean, people still get hammered after a tough loss, but not they don't pass out and puke in the clubhouse. I mean, that would happen with him. But as far as the actual numbers, I mean, I think he would really do well in triaging the information and figuring out what was important and what's not, because these but baseball players are they're not intellectuals, and they're not analysts. I heard a funny story. Pat Murphy, the Brewers manager, was talking about how when a front office guy came down to the clubhouse, he gives him a shirt that says Ivory Tower. And I think Earl would do something similar where he would say, okay, well, what you're giving us is not like, it has to have some use, but it's not just going to like pass it along to the players without digesting, without saying this matters, this doesn't, this is what would be useful. Because that's what gamblers do. They synthesize a lot of information. So he would have been really good at that triaging thing. And I don't think in his, as a younger person, I don't think it would have scared him. I think he would have seen baseball as baseball, and he would have picked out what he thought could help him win.
Now, you mentioned his drinking problem. Is that why he left the game at such a young age? Because he
Yeah,
was in his mid-50s when
he
he
was only
stopped managing.
51 the first time. Yeah, I mean he part of it. I mean he lived to be 82, which is pretty shocking because he smoked three or four packs of cigarettes a day.
Yikes.
I mean, by his own words, he only cared about baseball since he was four, and he was burned out in a kind of classic sense. Like I left the Wall Street Journal at age 39 because I was just tired of doing it. And people, their careers go in a certain way, and then all of a sudden they don't feel like it anymore. It's not in their hearts. And I think that's also probably what happened. I think there was a beauty to that integrity that he could have made a lot of money staying in baseball, but just didn't feel like it anymore and didn't have it in him to pretend. And he came back for a year and a half for the money, and it didn't work out. He was bad at his job for the first time, and then he quit for good. And that, he only had he had one losing season his first year in the minors in 1957 with a team in Fitzgerald, Georgia. And then he had 26 consecutive winning seasons, which is really an extraordinary achievement. I mean, a manager doesn't always choose his players, and so to have 26 winning seasons in a row is really incredible. Then he had one losing season in '86, and then he was done. So it's a symmetry there, like one losing season, 26 winning seasons, and then one losing season, and that was it.
So it seems like almost the front office is looking for a reason to get rid of him. Just giving him a chance of one losing season after all the success, something was going on there.
Yeah, he only had they only gave him 1 year contracts for most of his career because they needed that out. I mean, he really was a difficult person to deal with at times, and the fact that he was a winner really was what insulated him from getting fired. He was never fired. He walked away from his last job, and it was yeah, again, it was a lot to handle, and it was made possible only by the success they had, which is really extraordinary. And people forget the Orioles won more games than any other team in the 70s, had a better run differential, and were incredibly successful under Earl Weaver. And there was no way they could fire him with that record.
So when I think of Earl Weaver, the comparison comes up Billy Martin. So how would you compare the two?
I mean, they were both geniuses. I mean, one thing I gained in writing this book, and I'm sure if you live in New Jersey, you'll appreciate this. I mean, Billy Martin was as big as much of a genius. I mean, incredible record of success, constantly turning around teams. He has some record for like most turnarounds or most times taking a team that had a losing season to the playoffs. I mean, but he was self-destructive in a way. And Earl had the same flaws, but somehow was less self-destructive. I mean, and Earl had this great line about Billy Martin. Billy understands baseball. He just doesn't understand life. And so there was a kind of tragic part to that character, whereas Earl Weaver was a more comedic part, even though they had the same problems. I mean, Earl was a little more disciplined with the fighting. I mean, in the minors, he once he was being heckled, and after running out of ground ball and getting caught out, he turned right into the opponent's dugout and got the stuffing beat out of him by an entire team, and they put him in the hospital. And after that, he never started another fight. And so, although he did go after players, I mean, Bobby Grich told me he tried to punch him, like much like Earl, Billy fought with Reggie Jackson. Earl would go after people physically. Yeah, so I don't know. There's a kind of charmed life aspect to Earl that Billy Martin didn't have. And they would often, I mean, it was very entertaining. They would performatively, jaw with each other in the media. And then one of the joys of this project was reading all these clippings from the 70s where, he reads like nobody's media trained. Nobody cares about what it looks like. They're just speaking the truth and trying to be funny and trying to be, entertaining for the writers. And they would say things like, next time I see that guy, I'm going to deck him, or he's the best manager who's ever been fired 4 times. Like they would just like talk trash, and it was very entertaining. And yeah, so yeah, again, I came to appreciate Billy Martin a lot more reading writing this book.
When you were doing the research on him, what surprised you most?
I mean, I knew that he came from a poor background, but the uncle who was the mobster and who was a violent person who shot his wife once during a drunken quarrel, who was doing hits for affiliates of Al Capone's mob, the violence of that background, and then just how much gambling was a part of baseball culture in the 40s. I mean, baseball has this narrative that you have the Black Sox scandal and Pete Rose, and in between, like things were relatively clean, but it's not really true. There was gambling at every game. There was prop bets. You could bet on pitch counts. You could bet on run differential, all kinds of things through bookies like Earl Weaver's uncle. And so the presence of gambling, I mean, I knew baseball, has been a bigger part of American culture than it is now, but the ubiquity of baseball in American life in the 40s. I mean, St. Louis had 89 baseball fields, and there was baseball in every neighborhood every day. And so Earl Weaver would walk out his front door, I mean, same in New York City or on the East Coast, like you walk out your front door and just see baseball. There'd be kids playing baseball at all time, all hours of the day. And Earl Weaver's dad ran a baseball team where he put an ad in the paper and said, need a shortstop, and he'd recruit players and they'd play all summer. And so and then there were 500 minor league teams that were functional going concerns in the late 40s, and every town had a team, and you'd walk out your front door and go to the ballpark. And so I knew sort of the vague outlines of this, reality of American life, but I didn't realize how big a presence baseball was and how it dominated the culture. And that explains why Earl Weaver was a national celebrity in the 70s that transcended baseball, where, he was a Playboy interviewer of the month the same year as Gabriel Marquez, who just won a Nobel Prize for Literature, and Ansel Adams and Ted Turner, these really big cultural, celebrities. That's how famous he was. And then I didn't really know much about him as a player, and I didn't really realize he was a pretty successful player, where he was called a jewel in the system, a gem. He was team MVP 3 of his first 4 years in the minor leagues. He was really good. And by the standards of the time, probably should have gotten a shot at the major leagues. I mean, baseball had recently been integrated, so as more black players came in, they were going to push out marginal players like Earl Weaver. So he wasn't destined for a great major league career, but he probably did deserve a shot. But he's also very self-destructive, and at that time started drinking more when he could have had a shot. And that was, as a baseball, I coach high school baseball at the biggest public school in Pittsburgh right now, and I'm very fascinated by how baseball is taught. And so I was able to track down Earl Weaver's high school coach's son, who gave me practice plans from the 40s. And so I was surprised by how good the practices were run, and the structure of youth baseball, amateur baseball, in the 40s. And so that was a big surprise. And really the main sort of fruit of my learning was reading about how he learned to play high school baseball in the 40s in St. Louis.
If you had to do this book again, would you do anything differently?
That's a good question. I read it. I dip into it from time to time, and I think just write through it another 10 times, and just there's turns of phrase, and every writer just thinks I could do this better if I had another chance. The first four chapters I think are really, really good, and I wish the rest of the book was that tight. Like I feel like it's there's just parts where I an adverb or whatever, just writerly things that I wish I could write a bit better. I would maybe add a beat about his life after he retired. There's not much in there. I'd had a chapter that was focused a lot around his grandson, who's this character I kind of love named Clownvis. He has an act in St. Louis. He's half clown, half Elvis. And I thought he was a riot. And so I wrote a chapter about his life after baseball, where a lot of it was about Clownvis, and the publisher was not that into it. So they asked me to cut it, and that was fine. But I could have maybe weaved in more about, I think he had a heart attack in the late 90s, and that's not in the book, and just a few more things about his life after he retired. But at the same time, it's not that interesting. I mean, he would show up at Orioles functions, and he would often, be drunk, and then he'd have to go on stage and make a speech, and he'd be great at the speech, and then come off the stage and so be drunk again. So they were kind of tired of dealing with him. And so yeah, stories like that, but it was hard to do it in a nuanced way. So I ended up just he just sort of skips from Hall of Fame in 96 to his death, basically. But again, this is somebody who lived on a baseball field, and also the people say, I mean, there's a one criticism is that there's not a lot about his personal life and his second marriage, and his widow is still alive, and just out of respect for her privacy, I didn't explore that. It's not a book about his marriage. It's about his life as a baseball person. And then I tried to talk to her twice. I think we talked once, and then she didn't want to talk again. So I just let that part go, really. There is stuff about the family and how he reunited with his kids and grandkids after he retired, and there's a beat about that. But yeah, so maybe more about the personal side.
Well, it certainly was a very well-received book, and obviously winning the Casey Award is just confirmation of how good the book was. Do you have plans for another project?
Not specific. I mean, I just had a kid. He's 1 year old,
Congratulations.
and I'm 48, and so I'm a first time dad, and I'm also coaching a high school baseball team and doing magazine writing. Doing a book's very difficult, as and people who, around so I feel like I will wait until I have an idea so good that I can't not do it. I think a lot of people get trapped into doing a second book after their first book does well. And as you know, even a very successful book is not does not make enough money to live off of. So I need to do projects that, I have a steady job with an economics data company that pays the bills. And so I'm going to wait until something comes along. But I'm very lucky. I feel very, it's been a real blessing to do a book that has been this well received. And I really didn't expect it because I knew a little bit about, books usually don't get this much attention. So I feel very lucky that it's worked out. I was coaching third base when they called to say it had made the Times bestseller list. And so then I was sort of weepy and I was trying to tell my players, like, guys, I just got this phone call. My book's on the New York Times bestseller list. And they don't read books, but they sort of knew it was a big deal. So it was fun to have them to share that with them. One of the boys was like, so coach, how does it feel to be a New York Times bestselling author? And he's not going to read the book, but it was a fun thing to share with the kids.
Sure. Well, John, it's been a pleasure talking with you. Again, we've been talking with John Miller, author of The Last Manager, How Earl Weaver Tricked, Tormented, and Reinvented Baseball. Congratulations again on the Casey Award and all best. Good luck.
Thanks. And thanks for what you do to promote baseball books, Ron. I really appreciate it.
My pleasure.